Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
Hello and welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to talk to Pat Spillane about Kerry's win against Tyrone in a few minutes' time. Jenny Murphy on Ireland's qualification for the HSBC Women's 7 Series. And Eamon Dunphy in all things Premier League. It's as short and as simple as that tonight in the show. You can text us in 51552, tweet at GameOn2FM on Twitter. And Alan Cawley and Conor Mortimer are with me in studio. You're both very welcome.
Thanks very much, Hugh.
Hey, Usain Bolt.
Usain Bolt.
Has he saved athletics from the brink of hell and the devil that is Jonathan Gatlin? Or are we all just losing our minds a little bit here?
Different. I think Gatlin there, Gatlin was saying today that he's not talking to the BBC, he's not talking to the media now because of what they were saying pre-race in relation to, you know, he's a drug cheat and how Bolt saves athletics and stuff like that. It's great for everybody that Bolt won it. I mean, he's only been training properly for probably 5 or 6 weeks. You know, it just shows his ability is
here's the thing. Here's the thing.
Getting carried away with the whole saving athletics stuff.
Hang on, this is my point here.
No,
right?
He doesn't dope you.
Do we believe that Usain Bolt is 100% clean?
I think it is, to be honest.
Do you believe he's clean?
Yeah, I do. And
why?
I want to as well.
Why?
He hasn't like a lot of the people with tests, the likes of Armstrong, that, how would you say it, have failed tests where people say they haven't, but the results haven't come out. Like Bolt said the other day there that he'd have no problem with his blood being publicly accessible or whatever it may be, you know what
I mean?
Yeah,
and look, I mean, obviously there's nothing to suggest that he's anything but squeaky, spanky clean, like a brand new penny. But
you know,
you look at Jamaica's,
Jamaica's
record at drug testing over the last couple of years, and it's pretty appalling to say the least.
Well, I think when you look at athletics on the whole, Hugh, and obviously what we've seen with the cycling world as well, it's hard not to be sceptical with what's going on and the stories we're reading and the reports you're hearing and this, that and the other. But I think for the good of the sport, rather than saving athletics, I think for the good of the sport, we're all hoping that he is clean.
See, I can understand the massive sigh of relief and the outpouring of, yes, Bolt did it, okay, because, you know, Gatlin's history is pretty well documented. And even you can actually make a pretty strong case that Gatlin has been as unlucky as he has been caught on the wrong side of the law. But, you know, I don't know. I still think in a sport that is just so many unanswered questions.
That's the problem.
The top guy, the superstar, why is he exempt from any of this disbelief that we have?
I think there's too much talk about the fact that Gatlin and the other guys are dopers. Like the way I look at people that do drugs that are in athletics or professional sports, that should be out for life and that's it. So we wouldn't be having the conversation about whether Bolt, if you were to track a full level team there, the seven runners or whatever it is, all clear. No, but if they're all clean
track.
Or whatever, clean, we wouldn't be talking, it's all dope. I mean, if you're doping in athletics, you'll be gone. That's it, out. And that's what we should be talking
about. Well, Asafa Powell, obviously, you know, Tyson Gay as well.
They've all did it. That's
Justin Gatlin.
They should just be out.
Yeah.
And leave Bolt.
I can see what you're saying, yeah. It's hard not to be sceptical, but I think we're all hoping. Maybe that's the best way of phrasing it. We're all hoping he's squeaky clean.
Yeah, but
and
we've got our squinted eyes. We've got our squinted eyes hoping. We're not, you know, we're kind of going,
well, what about
please.
What about just putting him down as a phenomenal athlete and he's a bit of a freak?
Yeah. Machine. Brilliant.
That's, yeah.
Machine. Absolutely.
That's the I view.
I'd love to take that. I'd take anything.
Well, take it.
Do it.
Take it?
Take it.
Do it.
Take it on this one.
Take this. Weekend highlights. JJ's little montage. Here we go.
Has it back from Fabregas. Now it's Hazard. And it's Pedro, and it's danger, and it's the lead for Chelsea. Pedro on his debut.
This was even more important than the Olympic qualifier in July. Realistically, if we're not in the World Series playing top-level matches, we'll find it very hard to improve. And playing against top teams now this year, I feel like the team is only going to get better and better, and the Olympic dream becomes a real reality after today.
It's sailed over for 40 metres out. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant from Barry John Payne. Kerry 18, Tyrone 114.
Great to be back in the All-Ireland final again, and great to have come out the right side of a ferocious battle.
We've just got the decision from the appeal committee, and they have decided to uphold the decision of the ground jury. Horsesport Ireland will be deciding based on what the information that the document contains, how to proceed.
I believe you would want these games later in the season, but in England you have so many big teams now that it's maybe more difficult to organise. When I was In Monaco in Italy, they had the rule that in the first seven games, the top four could not meet. And I don't know if that rule still exists, but the fixtures are like they are. You have to adapt them to win your games.
Well, it's important. Obviously, you're playing one of the rivals that you're hoping to be competing with at the top end of the table. So these games are important. They don't give the full picture of how it'll finish up, because you can, you know, draw or lose these games and still go on and achieve what you want to achieve. But of course, it's for the confidence and psychologically that they are important.
Bolt gets out pretty well, so does Rogers. Gatland's got out a little bit better though, and Bolt and Gatland are right together here. It's Gatland at the moment, and here comes Usain Bolt, and Bolt gets it!
It definitely means a lot, because I've been struggling all season. It took me a while to figure out what was the problem, and it's all about getting it together, so I'm just happy.
Yeah, Usain Bolt was pretty happy. So were the BBC commentary team, by the way.
Just said that, yeah. I don't know whether I agree with that, them all jumping around the place.
Cartwheels up and down the commentary box. I mean, there's impartiality and then there's downright, yes!
They were going bananas. Even, what's his name, the famous one, does all the commentary for the Athletics for BBC.
I'm going blank. It'll come back to me now. Brendan Foster.
Did you see him doing it, Jake?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. They played it on the highlights show yesterday as well. So not only did they not draw attention to it, they played it in the highlights section. I want to say a huge congratulations as well to Paul Dunn, who has qualified along with four other Irish players for the Walker Cup team to take place at Royal Lytham and St Anne's next month. Paul Dunn, Jack Hume, Gary Hurley, of course, carried even for Paul in the US Amateur Championships over the weekend. Gavin Moynan and Cormac Sharvin, all part of Nigel Edwards' team. So best of luck to the lads. Fantastic. I think it basically sums up how strong Irish golf is at the moment.
Yeah, as you said, five of them, Hugh, and Paul
is half the team.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, yeah. But sure, look, we've been saying this for how long about the golf, and they're phenomenal, really are, but I'm delighted for Paul, who we've had in here. He's had a great year. He wanted to go and play in this, didn't he, before he turns pro. So he's after getting his wish now, and good luck to him, and hopefully he performs very well.
Well said. Okay, Pat Spillane, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Listen, what did you make of Kerry's win yesterday?
I thought, you know, very much a case of the old dog for the long road. They ground out a result. They got the tough game I think they needed after this sort of one-sided game against Kildare. Hmm. Ideal preparation for an All-Ireland final, because they certainly weren't firing on all cylinders. They had to work hard. But like at the end of the day, the experience, the composure. I don't know, when Tyrone came back at them and the game a draw, Kerry didn't reel off the next 4 points on the trot. So, to be perfectly honest, it was a workmanlike performance. It was a game I never actually saw. After the first couple of minutes, once Kerry had settled down, it was a game that I actually never saw Kerry losing. I couldn't see them losing. I always believed they just had that little bit extra on Tyrone all the time. Now, you have to, at the same time, first of all, can I also say, it was a damn good game of football.
Yeah.
In atrocious conditions, you know. And people, you know, sometimes I'm often being accused and criticised of living in the past and constantly criticising the modern game. And yes, there was the modern game, because it was defensive systems, it was a lot of hand passing, but it was a superb game of football. Really skillful. The fitness levels, the skill level of the player, as good as you'd find in any generation. It was an excellent game of football. And, you know, you've got to credit what Mickey Hart has done, you know. He's an amazing manager. I put him up there always with, along with Mick O'Dwyer, I suppose Kevin Heffernan is the top three Gaelic football managers of all time. But, you know, they got relegated. He's rebuilding a Tyrone team for the third time. And they were very, very competitive, defensively very well organised, and put it up to the All-Ireland champions. So, you know, they didn't lose anything in defeat.
OK, we'll come back to Tyrone in just a minute. I mean, for me, it showed once again how adaptable Eamon Fitzmaurice is as a manager, Pat. I mean, if Kerry had their way, they wouldn't have played to that style yesterday, but he did set up his team to play in a manner that, I suppose, befits the opposition.
Well, I'm glad you used that word, adaptable, because I think the great teams and the great players are teams who can adapt, who can read situations and adapt their style of play. Either adapt before playing a particular opposition, or can change their game plan and adapt during a game. And I mean, we've seen that down through the years in hurling. I mean, people, when Cork came along with the possession type hurling under Donal O'Grady, you said, end of the era for traditional hurling for Kilkenny. Then Tip came along, a young team. Then Clare came along with Davy with their tactics, and you said, in the road. And at the end of the day, Kilkenny are still All-Ireland champions. And you look at the history of Kerry football, In the 50s, when Antrim came on the scene with hand passing, they said outdated Kerry football. Then Down came with the tactics in the 60s. Dublin with a ferocious fitness in the 70s. The defensive systems of Armagh, Tyrone and Donegal in recent years. And at the same time, Kerry are still, you know, up at the top. And the reason is that word adaptable. They're very, very skillful players, but they can adapt to any situation. If you want open football, Kerry can play open football. If you want a tight defensive game, Kerry can play that. And you allude to that man, Eamon Fitzmaurice. I couldn't see Kerry losing yesterday because I said they have a great manager now in Eamon Fitzmaurice. A manager who leaves no stone unturned. He is clinical in his analysis of the opposition. And he will come up. Once upon a time, Kerry were naive, innocent and romantic, and they went in to try to win a game by outscoring the opposition. Kerry can play a defensive game, like I said, as good as anyone, and it showed in last year's All-Ireland final where they came up with a defensive game plan. They had the game plan yesterday. Everyone knows, probably at this stage, that the way you start to counteract these blanket defences is by setting up a team, the mirror image of the opposition. And Kerry set up defensively for long spells yesterday. We're poor in the first half now. We're very poor in the first. But what do you like about Fitzmaurice? I mean, a great manager, the Brian Codys in this world, the Alex Fergusons in soccer. Great managers make brave calls. You know, they make gutsy calls. They're not slow in bringing off their star player. I mean, you look at the decision. Kieran Donaghy, the captain, had just scored a pint before halftime. Wasn't playing great, but he's taken off. That's what makes Fitzmaurice a great manager. And the second thing is, outside of tactical acumen, outside of his bravery in making good calls, like Cody, teams are selected on form and training. Man of the match yesterday, Johnny Buckley, had a terrible Munster final. Wasn't seen against the Kildare match. Man of the match. Stephen O'Brien taken off in the Munster replay. They said he'll never be seen again. He was back starting the next day because of form based on training. So he's a brilliant manager. I thought he'd have had a hard job coming in, managing some of the players he played with, the Mark O'Shea and all that, but he showed ruthlessness last year in dropping Mark for the All-Ireland semi-final. So a great manager, very cool, very calm, very composed, brilliant tactically, and like I said, not afraid to make the big calls.
We'll come back to Kieran Donaghy in just a couple of minutes. Conor Mortimer is with us in studio as well. Pat, Conor, what did you think of the game?
No, just similar to what Pat was saying, I enjoyed it as well. I think the first half was a bit kind of tetchy. As Pat said, Kerry weren't great in the first half, yet they're still up by a point at half time. Second half, they came into it a lot. What impressed me about them is the fact that when Tyrone did come back, the couple of times they did, particularly at the end, with 10, 12 minutes to go, they were level. And then Kerry reeled off the last couple of scores or whatever. And it kind of showed kind of more of a steeliness about them, and like their belief is always there. I mean, Kerry All-Ireland semi-finals and finals, this is where they kind of, this is their comfortable place, you know what I mean? They're well used to winning in semi-finals and finals. As Pat was saying about Fitzmaurice as well, I mean, it's a big call bringing off Donaghy when he did.
It was the right call though, surely.
At that time, he had a poor first half, but Colin Cooper had a very poor first half as well, didn't touch the ball rarely in the first half, yet played very well in the second half. The Kerry, the one query I'd have was the fact that Tyrone, the couple of chances they had, the goal chance they had, they kind of sliced through the middle a bit easier than they probably should have. Now, I would put that probably down to the fact that Mark O'Shea wasn't on the field. He would have steadied and stayed in the middle as opposed to letting players run through. And forwards win games. We allude to it every year, and that's what wins games. Defences will lessen scores from opposing teams, but forwards will win games here. And I think the two biggest scores yesterday, one of them was from Dunica Walsh, who was right in front of me on the Cusick side, and then Maher got a huge score as well. Now, there's not many midfielders in Ireland that kicked the same score that he kicked yesterday. On Tyrone's side, what surprised me, I think, in relation to their tactic, it kind of backfired on them a little bit in the second half, because Kerry were two up and they were holding the ball and Tyrone had everyone behind the ball. I mean, and then the crowd started kind of booing and stuff. Now, there was a lot more from Tyrone there than Kerry yesterday. So unless they're booing their own players, I don't know. But they needed to be getting the ball back, considering they're 2 points down. The defensive system is fine when you're ahead, but when you're losing the game,
there's no lead to protect. You have to change tact
and go on try and win the game.
The biggest turning point I found, Hugh, and it comes down to small margins. The keeper, right at the start of the second half, gave three terrible kickouts. Kerry reeled off 3 points within the space of, I'd say, 2 minutes. And that was the gap that ultimately finished off. It was 4 points in the end as well. And it just comes down to small margins because it was tight. It was tense, as you say, between the two teams. I thought the two teams played well. But the keeper gives away three ridiculous kickouts. And when he did kick it 60 or 70 yards when they were contesting him, they actually won a fair few bit of ball. But then, not alone that as well, it comes down to the three chances that Tyrone had to take their goals. They didn't take them. And that's ultimately what I think it boiled down to.
Pat, if you listen to Sean Kavanagh after the match, and if you listen to Joe Brawley's analysis after the game, and certain Tyrone factions and even neutrals, there was a suggestion that, you know, Tyrone were robbed. First of all, the second penalty that didn't go their way, and also that they probably deserved to win the game on the balance of play because of the chances that they didn't take. Would you buy into that?
Jeez, that's a lot of ifs, buts and maybes. I actually would have disagreed with my Sunday game colleagues after the game because I felt their analysis dwelt solely. I think a few of them were trying to get back into the good books of Tyrone because they were overly...
It did seem like that, I have to say.
They were a bit egging up Tyrone because the analysis focused, after the post-match analysis focused on the second penalty that they felt... Tyrone should have got, which was conclusively proved, I felt, last night by Kevin McStay that it wasn't a penalty. Yes, there's no doubt about it. Kerry were opened up by those goal chances, but unfortunately, Tyrone didn't take the chances. If Kerry had similar chances, I think they'd have put away at least two of the three. As regards the other refereeing decisions, he certainly didn't make a mistake with the penalty. He definitely made a mistake, all right, in giving a yellow card instead of a black card to Shane Enright, and he was incorrectly handed a black card to Ronan McNamee. But I thought, in fairness, the referee had a damn good game yesterday, and the referee didn't cost Tyrone the All-Ireland semi-final. And you know, I think as Conor just alluded to, you talk about defensive systems and teams who set up primarily as a defensive system. And that's the Donegals and the Monaghans and Tyrones. And defensive systems are about containing, they're about stopping the opposition, right? But at the end of the day, like Conor alluded to, defences don't win games, it's attack win games. And I was just looking at a couple, and there's a couple of problems with the defensive system. First of all, in Croke Park, it's a ferocious hard system to maintain for 70 minutes. When you have 13 fellas behind the ball, they don't kick the ball, so it's running game. And I think they ran out of steam, Tyrone. That's number one. Number two, with 13 men behind the ball, that meant you hadn't fellas up in attack. So you had for long spells, Darren McCurry was the only Tyrone forward, sometimes inside the Kerry 45. And the third problem, then, of course, when it's a system that's not designed to chase a game. It's a system that's designed to protect the lead. And when they have to chase a game, the flaws come in then, because when they had to chase the game for the last couple of minutes, that victory in sight, it leaves gaps in the back, and Kerry exploited for those 4 points. But you also look at the statistics. I mean, there's three teams left now in the race for Sam. Dublin are averaging 29 points thus far in the championship. Mayo have averaged 26 points. After yesterday, Kerry have averaged 22 points. Tyrone have averaged 16 points. And there, in the nutshell, is why Tyrone are not in the final. And you look at the last 31 minutes of the game yesterday. The last 31 minutes of the game, Tyrone got three scores, one penalty and 2 points on play. So at the end of the day, I just don't think they hadn't enough of an attacking plan or probably enough of a belief to get them over the finish line.
Conor, you know what stood out for me as being really impressive? You know, Kerry don't play that system very often. And in fact, you know, we saw it in the All-Ireland final again. They had to match Donegal and go toe-to-toe in a system that they weren't overly familiar with. Now, defensively, you could argue they've served up in certain patterns so far this season and been quite good at it. But for a team to be able to keep possession in such a tight space under massive pressure as they did yesterday and playing to a system by which they're not overly familiar with, it's fair to say, I thought they did really, really well.
No, I think, you know, I think Fitzmaurice would have kind of drilled it into them during the week, you know, not to bring the ball into the tackle. You know, they were very quick giving off the ball.
Okay.
If a fellow was 2 yards away from you, they were giving them the ball. It was all quick, quick, quick. You know, I think the difference with Kerry, I think, as opposed to, you know, other years, we'd say going back 4 or 5 years, where, you know, the best footballing team in the land and so on and so forth, I think, you know, they've probably two or three ways they can play now, as opposed to having one way. And I think Emma Fitzmaurice last year, kind of having won the All-Ireland has bought him, you know, the time in this year to make whatever changes he feels necessary without having the pressure of, you know, if you lose this game, there'll be a lot more pressure having won it last year, you know. You know, he's changing tact in certain games in the way they play. I think the difference with Kerry, with their squad that they have, you see a lot of managers will make substitutions and it'll probably be the same player
like for like
coming on in certain games. You might get one player, he'll come on at a certain stage in every game. Whereas I think the advantage that Fitzmaurice has, he's playing players for the particular game he's playing and bringing on players. I mean, you didn't see Paul Gavin yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, you seen Brian Sheehan coming on late in the middle of the field. He doesn't make decisions because, you know, for, you know, what's the word? For
just for the sake of just it.
For the sake of it. They're for
okay, well, on that then, Pat, I mean, you know, Kieran Donaghy was substituted at halftime yesterday, Kerry captain, and Paul Genny came on and played very, very well. I mean, you could argue that Kieran Donaghy was never really going to play well in the system that Kerry set up on yesterday.
Well, can I just go back to Conor's point?
Sure.
Talking about players used by, it's very interesting. He does pick horses for courses. I mean, and like I said, it's based on form as well. But Buckley would have been selected ahead of Sheehan yesterday because of his mobility and fitness and work rate. That would be. But it's very interesting statistic that out of the 16 championship games, Fitzmaurice has been in charge with Kerry. No, not one player has played all 16 games. And if you even go back to this year, from the team that played Tipperary, only three of the personnel that played yesterday were started against Tipperary in the first round. So, getting back to Donny, I felt sort of... I thought the delivery that he got was quite poor. So he wasn't being helped by the delivery. But at the same time, he was off the pace. He didn't look great. And once they bring Paul Gainey in, what it brings in, it brings, instead of being a one-dimensional type attack where they know the ball is going to go early, Gainey can win any sort of ball. He can win it high, he can win it low. Gainey has great movement, really great movement. And most importantly, Gainey is very accurate off right and left. And like I said, that's the beauty of Kerry. There's no team in the country, and that includes Dublin, that have a subs bench as good as Kerry. No team. And they have players who can come in and change a game and win a game.
Do you think it's unfair then to be, I suppose, putting a question mark over Kieran Donaghy as regards to the final and whether or not he should start, or will it be judged on its merits? And again,
Hugh, very simply, the Kerry team for the All-Ireland final will be based on training, on the training matches over the next two or three weeks. That's what will be picked. It won't be picked on the forum from Sunday or the forum from the quarterfinal against Kildare. I mean, when you think about it, that Kerry played Kildare and won by, what was it, 7 goals and 16 points to 10 points, right? No other manager in any sport would probably have changed a winning team, a team that won by 27 points. Yet for the last day, he made 3 switches. So that will tell you, you know, 3 switches in a team that had won, three substitutes in a team that had won by 27 points. That's the ruthlessness that makes the great manager that Fitzmaurice is. And that's why I tell you this, there is no one, there is not a single person that will be starting training again Tuesday, Wednesday night this week that will say, I'm certain of starting in the All-Ireland. Not one of them.
Connor, last word to you.
No, I agree. I agree, in fairness, what Pat is saying. The one advantage that Kerry will have now in the final, I think, in fairness, it'll depend who they're playing as well as what goes on in training.
Sure.
I mean, if it's Mayo, you could see Donaghy and Tommy Walsh standing in the full forward line. Two big men, as Mayo don't like, as Pat will know as well. On the Dublin side of things, you know, they'll owe Dublin from the Cluxton kick 2 years ago. They'll owe him for that, and Dublin aren't great on the high ball as well, so you could see a player that hasn't played feature too often this year going on what he does in the next couple of weeks in training as well.
Okay, Pat, before we go, if I gave you a free bet, Dublin or Mayo on Sunday?
Christ, I was just thinking,
come
can
on.
You imagine having Conor Mortimer feeding off Aidan O'Shea in the full forward line along with you, but I put my, I swear to God, I put my shirt in Mayo. Hugh, I really think Mayo have improved. I thought, I mean, the positioning of Aidan O'Shea at the edge of the square, absolutely brilliant, and has made a huge impact. I was impressed with the way they worked the sweeper system for the first time ever against Donegal. I'd love to see Mayo win in Ireland. I really would.
I
like Mayo people. I like Mayo teams. I like their footballing philosophy. The closer I'm getting to the game, Hugh, if you asked me a week ago, I'd have said Mayo. But every day I look at another video and every day I look at stats, I'm beginning to think pace. If Dublin bring their A game and I think of pace, that could be the difference.
Okay. Brilliant stuff as always, Pat. Thanks a million.
Lovely.
Pat Spillane there. Just in terms of, you were giving out high hell and stink about last year's All-Ireland final, right? And a lot of people agree with you. I mean, are you coming round to this tactical war of attrition battle that perhaps we saw yesterday?
Oh no, I've no problem with that, Hugh, because it's all about basically, as you were giving out there with Tyrone, the defensive system. I admire what they do, because if they go out and play toe for toe and try and turn it into a shootout against Kerry, they're going to lose every week. So that's the way they have to play. I thought they were really good yesterday. I think the stick they've taken over the last how many weeks has been very unwarranted in a lot of cases. I thought that young fellow was crucified for what he'd done in the diving situation and should never have been hammered the way he was. And for them to come out and perform the way they performed yesterday, and you can't say any of that was dirty play. They played football as good as anyone yesterday, and I thought they were very unlucky in the match.
Kerry had an extra man yesterday in Tyrone. Goalkeeper Mickey Hart must be hard up for keepers. The worst I ever saw in Croke Park. He couldn't even lob the ball into the square. I wouldn't pick him for Ragball Rovers, comes in a text.
We've had this issue about the keeper in relation to, I spoke about this coming back a few weeks about keepers taking frees, and I had said about the Tyrone keeper, he'll kick one or two, he'll miss three or four every game.
What I don't get about, and it's, I think Kevin McStay was talking about it last night on the Sunday game, and they're all mad into the short kick out now. We've seen Sligo against Mayo when they got annihilated a few weeks ago, and the keeper kicking short passes. Like, if you're a keeper, right, Hugh, whether the manager tells you to do this the whole time, after one or two, if you say, this is not working, lads,
change
surely
it.
You're man enough to make a decision yourself as the keeper and change it. Some of them, to me, it seems, if the manager is instilling that this is what we do, he continues to do whether they're winning or losing.
But isn't that what happens, though? I mean, if you go against the manager and you're wrong, they're gone. If you're following manager instructions, he can hardly drop you if you're just going to the Gordon letter of the plan.
Yeah, but they're losing 3 and 4 goals because of it.
Yeah. Well, lads, a great weekend for sport. Bolt saves Athletics and Kerry save Gaelic football. No matter who is in the final, we'll be able to watch it. Enough said. Cecile from Wicklow was obviously a big Tyrone fan. Colly, you're one to talk about impartiality, you tool.
I don't even know what he's on about.
Well, it's anonymous, so another brave one. Tom and Bray says, Kerry got a number of big calls their way against Mayo last year that were wrong. Pat, I think the term you're looking for is that Kerry play puke football too, good for the goose and all that. Well, I suppose the argument that he would say, and I'm not putting words in his mouth, but we have had this conversation, is that, you know, Kerry won't set up like that unless you force them into it.
And if
you force them into
it, they'll play whatever way they have to play.
Exactly. Why no comments about the norm that are so many thrown passes between the players on all sides of Pádraig? Yeah, well, that's just the way that Tyrone play it, and I suppose if you want to counteract that system and go up man for man, that's what Kerry had to do yesterday as well. No matter how good Kerry were, if Tyrone took their goal chances, the story would be about Tyrone team, a manager that sport.
He's right here with small margins. You can talk about Kerry playing great and Kerry doing this and Kerry doing that. Three kickouts from the keeper and the three chances for Terry, and it'd be a different ball game.
And neither Kerry or Tyrone played football as would be expected of teams in the semi-final. But the beauty of it now is that we have three teams left who all like to play football. And I can't wait for next weekend and whatever final
is. They all want to play football, but at the end of the day, it's about winning.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, but you don't expect Kerry to play like they did yesterday in the final.
They did it last year to win the All-Ireland.
No, but
against Donegal, though. They won't do it against Mayo or Dublin.
No, it'll be a shootout.
Well,
but they might do it against Dublin, actually.
It'll be a shootout.
You reckon?
Yeah.
Okay, we've got Jenny Murphy coming up. Stay tuned after the break.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
Keeper text coming in 51552. The Ireland women's sevens rugby team qualify for the HSBC World Series this coming season after reaching the final in their home tournament yesterday against Japan. One of the players involved was Jenny Murphy, and I'm delighted to say that she joins us on the line now. Hiya, Jenny.
Hey, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Listen, congratulations. This is it's a brilliant achievement.
Thanks very much. Yeah, delighted. We've our main goals achieved for the season now, so really happy with what we've done and just aiming to kind of kick off the World season now with a good start.
Yeah, okay. So anyone who has watched Sevens or anyone who's played Sevens knows how difficult it is, you know, under normal conditions to get your footwork right, get your handling skills right, keep the ball alive. How difficult was it playing over the last 2 days, given the weather we had in Dublin?
Saturday, it wasn't too bad. Sunday was definitely a lot more difficult. The ground held up really well, just kind of wet ball. There was a lot more knock-ons in the games than maybe would normally happen. But to be fair, we were used to training in that kind of weather anyway, so it was really no excuse. Maybe just slowed the game down that little bit, but all in all, it wasn't too bad. So yeah, a bit slower than normal, but it was good.
Take me back to the pool match against South Africa and the final whistle goes there. So what are you thinking and what's the mood in the squad after losing that match?
Very disappointing for us. And we did kind of, our heads were quite low for a while. But then going back into the changing rooms, first day, it's not as important. You want to get a few wins, but it's game day two is vital, and lucky enough we knew we were gonna we had a decent chance of, if we beat China on our first match of day two, we'd meet South Africa again, so the chance to get a bit of revenge and kind of make amends for what we thought was maybe a poor display on our part. So yeah, we were very disappointed, but delighted to get another crack at them day two.
You see, and that's sports psychology at its best, and I was wondering, you know, what the mood in the squad would be like, because on the one hand, if you just imagine you've gone out and you've beaten South Africa pretty comfortably, Jenny, I wonder, would you have almost taken it for granted then that, you know, should the match come around again, that that's what would happen? And I'm wondering, was that the kind of kick you needed maybe to say, right, okay, that performance wasn't good enough, but we're still there and we still have a chance?
Definitely. I think it stopped us from getting complacent. I think our first two games we won quite easily. And South Africa definitely put up a challenge and we didn't rise to the occasion. And I think it worked out better for us in the long run. I think we were gunning for them after that. Very disappointed, knew what we had to do and knew the improvements that we had to make. So I don't think they were expecting us to come out the way we did. So to be fair, I think it worked very well for us. And even that night, we were kind of like, no, this is a good thing for us. And we can learn from a loss a lot more than from a win. So definitely happy that it worked out the way it did.
They're quite a physical team, and they have been, you know, in the World Series. They're very fit as well. A couple, three or four players really epitomised that. What was it in particular that you kind of reckoned you could hurt them, if you like? Was it one or two areas that you said, okay, this is where we need to improve?
They're very physical around the breakdown, but we knew if we got in fast, worked in our pods of three and sent the ball to first receiver and just moved quickly and worked together really hard, that eventually they would break. We trained so hard and we knew ourselves that we were the fitter team. We could tell that from the first game we played against them. So we just had to keep possession was vital. Defending in sevens it's not the nicest to be. So 2 minutes of defending with us moving the ball constantly and gaps will open up and they did. So that was our aim, just direct for a while, then move direct again and the gaps would open up.
Okay, well, look, obviously the final didn't go Ireland's way, but I mean, on the overall picture, it's fantastic to have booked the place in the World Series. And with that Olympic qualifier coming up next season as well, you're going to have the best possible format to kind of develop your game, harden yourselves, so that when the repechage comes along, you'll be in the best possible shape you can be in.
Yeah, to get to the best that we can be, we need to be playing against the best, and at the moment the best are all the World Series, is where it's at, like New Zealand, Australia, England, France, Russia. There will be all, we'll face them on a monthly, or well, I think six times throughout the year. Yeah, in some big tournaments, and you need to be playing against them to get like match experience. It's invaluable, and when we play that amount, we can improve our game even more so than we have already, and then we have a massive chance of getting that top spot for the final place in the Olympics.
So, what does this mean for you, and say for a couple of other players who maybe need to concentrate exclusively on sevens for the next while? Do you know what the future is going to hold now?
To be honest, I'm not too sure, I'm not really worried about it. I know that I'll be managed well, and it's done on a player-by-player basis. Obviously, we want to retain that Six Nations championship, and you want to play Six Nations, and if I could, I'd love to do both.
Is it a possibility?
Yes, they definitely don't want to rule out one or the other. So I know we'll get the chance to do either or. It's just, it would take it as we come, and it depends how well we're training with sevens and what tournaments are coming up. So obviously that'll be for management to deal with, but we're hoping that we're going to get as much game time as we possibly can. And as well as that, there's a lot of new faces coming up in the 15 squad too, so they're challenging us for our places as well. So it's brilliant. It's a brilliant place to be, that everyone's fighting for a position, not just in sevens, but in 15s as well. So it's difficult, and you want to retain that jersey. But the fact that there's such a fight there is brilliant for women's rugby in this country in general.
But I suppose if you want to be really strict about it, and I'm just talking letter of the law here, I mean, there is a case to be made that one harms the other, that 15s doesn't suit sevens and vice versa, and that, you know, it takes a long time to get out of habits of both games. So if it came down to it, would you be happy to make a choice and stick to it?
I don't know. I haven't actually thought about that myself.
Okay.
At the moment,
I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No. At the moment, I probably disagree with you a little bit, in terms of, I think that if I'm doing really well in sevens, it's going to make me a better rugby player in general, and that's going to help my 15s and vice versa too. Mm. Obviously, along the line, maybe skills get even more specific. But at the moment, they're definitely complementing each other, and so far so good. My 15s coach hasn't complained okay. Too much either, and he did the 7, so hopefully
he hasn't seen too many bad habits then. Listen, Jenny, thanks a million. It's hugely exciting. I mean, look, you're going to be off travelling the world next year, and I've been lucky to go to a couple of tournaments. It's fantastic, so best of luck with everything else to come.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Super stuff. Well done, Jenny. And Ireland off to the HSBC World 7 Series, Dubai, Cape Town, Canada and the likes next season. All the support they can get, I'm sure. Okay, 51542 for your text. Let's take a break. We're back with Eamon Dunphy after these.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
Joe and Tralee text us in. Hugh, what a sweet win yesterday. Kerry can adapt to anything now. We beat Donegal last year, and at the sweetest of the lot, Tyrone, our bench again yesterday, won it. Gainey, a class act. Thanks for that, Joe. 51552 for your text. But big game tonight in the Premier League, Arsenal against Liverpool. Nigel Bidmead is there. Nigel, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Hugh. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. We're looking forward to this one. I have a funny feeling that Arsenal are going to run riot here tonight, but the Liverpool fan here, Conor Mortimer, and Alan Cawley, who's the expert, is shaking his head. What's your view?
I don't think they will.
Okay, I'm on my own.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I mean, I think Liverpool have slightly changed their style, haven't they?
Yeah.
A touch more defensive, a little bit more organised, a little bit more mindful of their duties without the ball. And I think when I tell you about their team news, you may well agree. Let's start, though, with Arsenal, because they've got some really bad news. Their captain, Per Mertesacker, is ill, and his regular centre-back partner, Laurent Koscielny, is also out. He has a back injury. Callum Chambers and Gabriel are the replacements. Santi Cazorla skippers the side. So Arsenal will line up with Cech in goal. Bellerin is the right back. Chambers and Gabriel, the centre backs, and Ignacio Monreal, the left back. Santi Cazorla and Francis Coquelin, the defensive midfielders. Aaron Ramsey on the right. Mesut Ozil in the middle, and Alexis Sanchez on the left, with Olivier Giroud up front, who's playing his 100th, or will be making his 100th Premier League appearance. Now, for Liverpool, they're also without their captain, Jordan Henderson. He's failed to recover from a foot injury. He went off in the last game. Emre Can deputises. James Milner is handed the armband. There's also a first start for new signing Roberto Firmino, and featuring for the first time this season is another Brazilian, Lucas. And I think that change there, Lucas in for Lallana, is the key to how Liverpool will play, because Lucas obviously a much more defensive-minded midfielder than Lallana. So Liverpool lineup: Mignolet in goal, Klein is the right back, Skrtel and Lovren the centre backs. Joe Gomez, the teenager from Charlton, the new signing from Charlton, is the left back. James Milner, the captain, plays alongside Emre Can and Lucas, and then Philippe Coutinho and Roberto Firmino, the two Brazilians, will support Christian Benteke up front. And I would think Christian Benteke is thinking, yes, I'd like to have a go at those two new centre-backs.
Yeah, I'd say he is. Listen, thanks a million, Nigel. Appreciate your time and enjoy the game. Thanks a million.
Cheers to you.
Nigel Bidmead there at the Emirates Stadium. Eamon Dunphy's on the line. Hey, Eamon.
Hey, Hugh.
Can I ask your thoughts on this? I'm really in the Arsenal camp, but I suppose a little bit worrying that their two centre-backs aren't there. But Liverpool were a little bit lucky against Bournemouth, equally against Stokes. I'm not sure about this one.
Yeah, well, I'm not really. I think Arsenal will miss those players. And I think Nigel was right. I think Benteke will look forward to playing against that back four. And I think they're a bit light as well in midfield. They got a lot of similar types of players, Arsenal. Ozil, for example, will he have a go tonight or not? We know Sanchez will have a go. Cartola, yes. But I think it'll be a close match. It's a test for Liverpool, obviously, because they've got some tough games to come. But I wouldn't be rushing in to back Arsenal at Ozan.
Okay. Manchester City are setting quite a pace at the moment. I mean, it's still very early days, obviously, but they already look like the team to beat.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they have the strongest squad. Sterling makes them even stronger. And the other big clubs have their problems. Manchester United have chronic problems. And I think Chelsea have real problems as well. They didn't really bring anyone in the summer. They've got Pedro now. And of course, we know Arsenal have problems. So by default, Manchester City have got off to a very, very good start. And they look a useful side. And they've a good centre-half to come in. The guy they bought from Valencia last week is a very good player. He didn't start at Goodison yesterday. So they do look like the team to beat. We'll see how they get on in Europe when they're playing serious teams, and we see how Yaya performs when he has to actually work. But for the moment, they're by far the best team in the Premier League this season.
Yeah, because in your piece in the Star today, you mentioned that, you know, Yaya Toure plays when he wants to play. And it's quite disconcerting, because that's true. And you know, if he decides, look, I'm going to take a break for a couple of weeks and I'm going to take the foot off the gas a bit. I mean, you know, when he ticks, Manchester City are brilliant. But when he doesn't, they tend to struggle.
Yeah, and I don't think he's got the legs, to be honest with you, Hugh, to play against, you know, serious opposition in midfield. I think he'd be found out. I don't think he's as fit as he ought to be. I don't think he cares as much as he should. But he goes to West Brom, and, you know, he was credited with the first goal, and he scored the second goal. It was a brilliant goal. And yesterday at Goodison, you know, there was a divine chip for Sami Nasri's goal. But Sami Nasri is another guy with a weak heart. And you've got Fernandinho in midfield with Toure. Now, them two, you know, are a problem. But then look at Aguero, look at Silva, who's probably the best player in Europe at the moment outside of Barcelona. And they have Sterling as well, who's a real threat. Vincent Kompany back, fit, you know, and a real leader. So they have assets. But whether they'll be able to, you know, progress this year to the knockout stage of the Champions League will be a more accurate gauge of where they are rather than where they are now in the Premier League, because there isn't really another Premier League club with their act together at the moment.
Alan, I watched Manchester United play on Saturday against Newcastle. I watched Manchester City. I was flicking between the two matches yesterday. And chalk and cheese to me. What's your view?
It's chalk and cheese to me as well, Hugh. It's roles reversed almost when you think of where United were many years ago, and now City have totally overtaken them. And it's almost like watching the old United with the attacking intent that City have, and United just look so lackluster in attack. They really do. And it's the three games. It wasn't just Saturday as well. They were poor against Spurs in the first game of the season as well. They got a couple of wins, fair enough, but I watched them against Newcastle and it was so frustrating. And what I don't understand, Hugh, is with the management that's going on there, how you can have a situation where Van Persie and Falcao were kind of the centre forwards last year, and Rooney, those times Rooney played in midfield. Obviously Van Persie and Falcao have left the club, which looks to me, that was obviously the right thing, but it looked to me last year that He was thinking Rooney down the pecking order, and he had them two ahead of him. Now he has Rooney as the main man, and he had a fella who was totally discarded in Chicharito off at Real Madrid. He has him now back at the club, who's second choice to come on. So the management and the thinking that's going on there, how, like, there's only a week to go in the transfer window. If they don't get a centre forward, well, then they can forget about it.
Yeah, I mean, we keep hearing rumours that Man United are preparing to make big signings. Anyone from Gareth Bale to Neymar to Muller at Bayern Munich. I mean, so far nothing has materialised. Even Pedro, who looked to be at almost certainty, decided to go to Chelsea at the last minute. What's going on here?
I think they have a new chief executive, Woodward. They missed David Gill, who was there with Ferguson for many years and got the business done. Ferguson said, that's the player I want. The guy went off and did it. Woodward started off very badly when he paid $4 million over the odds for Fellaini last year. Just after he started in the job, he looks as if he's a guy who tries to shave a few bob off the price and gets gazumped by Mourinho.
I would argue he paid $24 million too much.
Yeah,
for
I think this guy doesn't know. He's a marketing man, and they've given him a job in one of the biggest football clubs in the world, one of the biggest sporting institutions in the world. He's come from a marketing department somewhere, and they've given him the job of dealing in the football transfer market at the highest level. It's like sending a kid into O'Connell Street and asking them to find their way across the road. A two-year-old, that is.
Yeah.
So, and all that stuff about Neymar and Ronaldo, don't forget, earlier on,
yeah,
it was a buzz for about 10 days that Ronaldo was coming back. That's just spin. And I think we said it on this show. I said, I think Van Gaal is a spoofer. I said this, what, 6 months ago?
You said it a lot, Eamon, yeah.
And I know that's a dangerous thing to say, but everything I hear him say and everything he does with the team seems to me as a guy who's making it up as he's going along. And the main thing is he doesn't want to concede goals, and he seems to have a lot of bodies behind the ball, no support for Rooney, and a couple of duds in the team. It'll be interesting...
He said he was satisfied by what he saw against Newcastle. I mean, Newcastle.
He said
awful.
They were fantastic. He said they were fantastic, was the actual word.
Fantastic.
They were terrible. And, exactly. You know, they have. They don't really have enough quality players. They don't have near enough quality players. This young lad, Yanazai, might become a player, but he's lightweight. The new player, Memphis, did okay in the Champions League, but. He's raw. He's a million miles away from being, you know, a top player. He wouldn't get in Manchester City's reserve team. And where are they with... they bring on Valencia. That's a blast from the past as a sub.
Schweinsteiger looked huffing and puffing, but, you know, he just... He's gone, is he?
Well, I mean, Schweinsteiger isn't fit.
Yeah, he doesn't look it.
Well, he seems to be...
They gave Bayern Munich a gift of 20 million euros because... he wouldn't get in Bayern Munich's team. He only played 15 matches last year. He's clearly struggling to get around the pitch. And everyone is talking about him as being, you know, exactly what Manchester United need, including former Manchester United players who are working on television analysis.
I was down at an over-35s Greystones match on Saturday playing myself, and some of the lads who came off after extra time looked less huffing and puffing than Schweinsteiger did after 50 minutes.
Guardiola said only last week that he hasn't been fully fit in 3 years.
Is it a case, though, Eamon, then, that Manchester United are just not a draw for the top players anymore?
I think that is a big factor. I don't think even for managers. I think Guardiola would like to live in London. He spent his sabbatical year in New York, and I think if he went to Manchester, he'd want to run a million miles to London. I think players are the same. They're extremely well off now compared to most other athletes, and I think if you said to them, would you like to live in London, I think Pedro would probably, and you know, his wife or girlfriend, very excited to go and live in one of the great cities in the world. Now, I love Manchester, but it's an acquired taste, and the weather is an acquired taste. So I do think the football factor, as well as the quality of life factor, doesn't make Manchester appealing.
Connor?
Surely, Eamon, with Pedro, with United, I'm sure he had spoken to Valdez in relation to Van Gaal's treatment of him and stuff like that. I don't think that certain players will want to play for Van Gaal, because I personally think he's outdated.
I think that's right. I think, you know, he's very, he's got a very big ego and a presence about him, which is fine, but he's not doing his stuff. The situation with De Gea is a disgrace. Mm. I mean, he's sitting in the stand, and it looks like it's a game of poker, but Real Madrid have four aces, and Van Gaal has a pair of juices. De Gea is going to walk for free. He can do a deal in January,
yeah,
and he's worth 35 million.
Yeah.
So they're bluffing that one out. That's probably Woodward as well. But I would bet you a pound to a penny De Gea will be on that flight this week. If they're not, Manchester United are mad. They've just burned 35 million.
One quick one from Graham Eamon, who says, I think Manchester United are waiting to make sure they make the Champions League group stage and will make one big signing when that cash is secured. That's a, if that's true, what Graham is suggesting, that's a very risky gamble.
Well, it is, and the players, you see, aren't there. I mean, one of the most important facts at the moment is that there's more money chasing fewer players. And even if they wanted to make that signing, I don't think that player is there, because the players we're talking about are all settled at the top clubs in Europe, like Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich. There's no way they're going to sign for Manchester United in the last days of the transfer window. So we'll see what happens with that particular proposition. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay. Listen, we'll have to leave it. We're just out of time, Eamon. Thanks as always.
Okay.
Super stuff, Eamon Dunphy there. George says, how come top players will go to Man City? Weather is the same with that ground. Probably about 100 grand a week in the
exact
difference
same thing,
there,
yeah. You can't use that argument. Of course players want to go to London, that's fair enough. But to use that argument, sure, what about Silva and Aguero? They're all living in Manchester. It's fine for them.
Okay, my thanks to Alan and to Connor, to Damien and to JJ as well on the show tonight. I'm off to watch Arsenal hammer Liverpool by 3-0. Stay tuned, Louise is on. No, it's not Louise, Mark. Yeah, Mark McCabe on the way.